Yeah, it's not a little different. You know, I think even if you took out 90% of the hype, you've got a capability that is twice as big as electricity.
If you believe we can change the narrative, if you believe we can change our communities, if you believe we can change the outcomes, then we can change the world. I'm Rob Richardson. Welcome to Disruption Now.
Welcome to Disruption Now. I'm your host and moderator, Rob Richardson. As always, please like, subscribe. We're here at 1819. We're honored to have them as a sponsor. With me is special guest Pete Blackshaw, who is the founder of BrandRank AI. Also, he was the former leader of Centrifuge, which is the central ecosystem here in Cincinnati. And before that, I think he did stuff with Nestle and was doing things in digital innovation. So he's been innovating and disrupting for a while. Pete, great to have you on the show.
Hey, good to have you. Thanks for inviting me.
So, Pete, you know, you're this is your second startup, right? Like, what made you jump into the startup world again at this point?
In both instances, you know, I was in a moment. Kind of an inflection point in the digital world where you just knew that a disruption, you know, as you would put it, was upon us. And, you know, I struggled on the AI thing, trying to convince myself that it was hype, shiny new object. And as I used the tool myself, which has been personally transformative, I concluded that this was the time to take the plunge. And it's a little bit scary, you know, at my age, two kids going to college, but I concluded that I would never forgive myself if I didn't, you know, take a shot at it. And there's some, I'm working on an idea that I'm particularly passionate about. So if you can kind of align a historic moment with a personal passion, you know, why not? And then the other thing I was just thinking about was, I just think, you know, AI expertise is going to be so in demand. There's no downside if you jump into it, because you're going to learn 10 times faster in a startup mode. You may come out with no cash. You may come out a failure.
That happens.
Technically, but there's going to be a lot of opportunities post that experience. And so for me, it was an acceptable risk. And but I'm really excited about kind of shaping the space.
So AI's been around for a long time, like, you know, so, but it was obviously generative AI that really kind of sparked you. What do you see as this moment? Like, I know a lot of people always say this is going to change everything at many moments in time. And there's been a couple of times where that's been true. But this time feels a little different. I want to get your perspective on how you think AI is going to shape and change business in our world in general.
Yeah, it's not a little different. You know, I think even if you took out 90% of the hype, you've got a capability that is twice as big as electricity. And I often say this is as much
twice as big as electricity.
Yeah, I really, I really believe that. And I've often said that, you know, I think one of the biggest historic moments was the Gutenberg printing press. You know, all the knowledge was kind of stored in the hills with the monks, you know, and that liberated everything.
Absolutely.
It was almost like social media on steroids, right? And, you know, this is, I mean, this is like intelligence that's highly accessible. It is iterating at a scary pace, so fast that policy can't keep up with it. None of us can really kind of keep up with it. And we're not really sure where it's going to lead. And there's always a dark side of technology that we need to be on top of. That's why you and I are taking a proactive and important lead on responsible AI. But yeah, this is absolutely huge. I mean, just think about it from a, you know, businesses are going to be transformed. There will, in fact, be a lot of job dislocation. That doesn't mean net jobs will go down. But
is that a nice way of saying job loss?
I think as leaders, we have to get really in front of what the workforce could look like. You know, what does it mean to co-pilot with this new capability? And what does it mean to say bye-bye to a certain industry, but hello to a new one? This is where universities play a really big role. But universities can also be part of the problem if they don't kind of get in front of it.
If they don't evolve.
Yeah, that's why I think this kind of, this island of the future, 1819 digital futures, is really, really important at this critical moment in time. But it's big. It's going to change everything.
I'm obviously pro innovation across the board. You know that,
of course.
I do have concerns because I think this is different than past technologies. Like, so past technologies have been sometimes industry specific. We've had very little data on you know, general purpose technology. The internet was a general purpose technology. So that's one example, but there's not many. And I think AI is a general purpose technology where it's not getting rid of or modernizing one industry. It's not the Luddites where it's just like
it's across the board.
It's across the board, right? Yeah. It's like we've gotten to the point where we're, I think Mark Cuban said this, we're automating automation. And we don't know what that looks like in terms of the job, in terms of the workforce, in terms of what it looks like. It's a, to your point, it's ever changing, and systems and businesses and everyone else have to adapt quickly. So I'd like to hear from you, like, what is your biggest concern that business, that people aren't realizing about AI? And then we can talk about the biggest opportunity.
Yeah, well, the biggest concern is that people are going to kind of miss the boat, and and when you're not kind of in front of it, you know, you get a little bit rash and reckless, and maybe you push the wrong policies out of fear and paranoia. And that's understandable because there's a lot of unknown.
Yep.
I've been, since the very day it came out, I think this can cut in a couple different ways on the access and equity side. There's a part of me that believes, that knows that this is a revolution in access. And so therefore, if we get ahead of the curve, we could redefine the rules of access for entrepreneurs.
Absolutely.
Like I've co-led workshops with minority small businesses where these tools have allowed these businesses, which have not had access to a lot of resources, tools and the like, to kind of get a lot of them up front.
Absolutely.
In fact, the job issue is almost moot at the small business level.
It gets
complicated at the big level. It gets complicated at the white collar level. It gets complicated at the service level. And that's one area that I think is disproportionately represented by minorities. And that's where, and we just got to get in front of it.
Yeah.
You know, and this is where I think leadership is really, really important.
I agree.
And I think, and I would say, I would give credit to the state of Ohio, kind of both sides of the aisle for, you know, thinking ahead. Again, I think that's why you're creating these innovation hubs and the like, but we have to shape the dialogue. And we need to, you want a little bit of paranoia, right?
Yeah.
I think that keeps people on guard, but we also have to help people see possibilities. I mean, what makes me different? Well, not different. I think I probably put you in the same camp.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an urgent optimist.
Yes,
so I see possibilities. I'm not a total cynic. I'm not on the dark side, Armageddon, you know, but I recognize that if you want the optimism, you have to get it with urgency.
Absolutely.
You cannot, and then this is what we're kind of doing right now.
Yeah. What happens if we get it wrong?
Listen, I think it's going to be, it'll probably change the political environment. You know, you've just got a lot of polar extremes in the marketplace and the political environment on both sides. And I think where there's fear, there's division, and where there's the unknown. And so, yeah, this could get really ugly. And I don't think we've, you know, we've dodged a few bullets with a couple of the strikes that have taken place.
Yeah.
And I think the Hollywood thing landed, and I think they kind of found that the hybrid model. There could be some industries that really create a lot of political instability. And
absolutely.
So we just got to get in front of it.
And
I think there's going to potentially, there's some, some racial issues we're going to have to be really sensitive, like who is helped and who is not. And this is where we need to be really attentive to, the different sectors. I thought McKinsey did a really good job about 4 months ago looking at which groups will be impacted or not. But they also had they kind of had the same thing we said earlier, like if we're proactive and we lead it, we can get in front of it.
Yeah. So I agree with that completely. And I we already have data on this. The issue, like we know what algorithms do without any type of thought process, guardrails. That's what social media became. And that's how we got, these are part of our human nature, if we're honest. We have these, part of our human nature to be prejudiced against others. It's part of our human nature to be misogynist sometimes, to do things. These things, it depends upon what we want to emphasize. And unfortunately, right, we know a lot of the algorithms focus on outrage and conspiracy. So those things tend to divide. And they do that not because they're trying to focus on those things, because their goal is singular.
Well, algorithms are rules, and all rules are written in different ways.
Correct.
And all rules manifest themselves in dial that may be
correct.
A little bit to the right or a little bit to the left. In fact, this is kind of the heart of what we're trying yep. to measure as part of my new startup.
Which we're going to get to.
And yeah, and we just need to be hypersensitive to where we think the dial needs to to sit in a way that it positively impacts the economy, consumer
confidence,
possibilities.
You have to be aware. You have to be aware that there could be issues.
Oh, no question.
Right, like, and that's what it gets to, because it's algorithms are rules, but you know, generative AI is also the baby you're training on the data, and it's going to reflect what you input to it. Which is why it's so important.
Absolutely.
Which is why it's so important to be inclusive. So, but tell us. Okay, but you entered into AI wanting to solve a specific problem. What got you up at night? What problem are you trying to solve with using AI as a tool? Because I tell people, it's not the technology, it's the problem you're solving. So what problem are you solving?
Well, let me take a step back. So I came to Cincinnati after 8 years in Switzerland leading digital work for Nestle and had a chance to all over the world and really kind of see the digital revolution taking
sure.
place in different ways. And so I came back to Cincinnati to lead this startup accelerator fund of funds to really kind of grow the local internet economy. And in the process of trying to figure out like where we could lead, I'm a big believer that internet economies where there's a concentration of talent, technology, and capital have kind of an outsized advantage. And so the areas that have been not just keeping me up at night, but actually making me want to go to work were areas like sustainability or resilient supply chains. That was a big theme that came out of COVID. A lot of things on the health front, but then as the AI stuff started to develop, especially in the last 18 months, thinking a lot about the power of responsible AI, could a region that has really good consumer credentials. Again, you got the world's largest advertiser here, the world's third largest retailer here, and a whole ecosystem that supports that. So could we leverage those consumer chops credentials to get in front of these very complicated issues? And moreover, could we cultivate a lot of entrepreneurs that would want to be the problem solvers or the heroes in that area? And I found myself as a pretty loud cheerleader, let's do it. And then I kind of got to that moment of truth and I just said, I'm just going to do it myself.
Right.
You know, give up this really big salary and be part of the solution. I mean, there's a whole nother element of wealth creation if you're successful. And what I've been thinking about, you know, the areas that I get excited about is really the collision of AI and sustainability.
So
I actually think I do lose sleep about the world not kind of keeping up with its carbon commitments.
Sure.
And I think AI is a huge opportunity to kind of move that ahead. And some of my inspiration has come from local companies like 80 Acres, where they use 99% less water because of the way they use artificial intelligence, you know? And so there's some inspiration. So I think as we get smarter at the use of AI plus sensors, I mean, we could dramatically change the green landscape, and I would like to see it cultivated, you know, here in our backyard.
Yeah. So it sounds like you were working to be an entrepreneur, but like, you decided the best way to do that, you had to go exit.
I've always kind of worked in, I was thinking about this the other day, I've always worked in like 5 year cycles. So I was only everybody thinks I was a P&G veteran. I was only there for like 5 or 6 years. And then after we got Interactive Marketer of the Year, I left to do a startup. And then I did the startup was a bit of a slog. It took us a while before we got sold to Nielsen, but then I went to Nestle and then I went.
Startups are usually a bit of a slog.
Centrifuge was kind of a hybrid between big company and startup. There are elements of that were kind of pretty big and bureaucratic.
Yeah.
There are other parts that were kind of startup nimble.
Yeah.
And now
it feels
back
very,
into
like, I know this probably sounds, but it feels very corporate sometimes, but go ahead. That's my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, it sparks a big debate. I mean, listen, we have a storefront for services, but we also work with corporates and we're trying to figure out how to unlock that startup corporate connection. And it's harder than it looks. Yeah.
Challenging.
No, and it's hard.
Because it's different cultures.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, what's different today, it's like, again, you have to exploit the moment. There's always moments where the organization needs to be stimulated. And I think AI is a moment where startups might have a chance to kind of get in the door, because there's a lot the big cos don't really fully understand. You know, and I'm hoping that I'll be one of those folks that does get in the door because I'm bringing an outside-in perspective on a very, very fast-evolving world. It's just very, very hard to move fast in an organization. And organizations are really good at, like, bottling up their learning and everything is about disseminating and executing against the learning. But now in the world of generative AI, you got a whole different playbook that's being developed.
Yep. So, brand rank AI. You create this. Like, what, again, I can go back to that question. Like, what is brand rank seeking to do?
So I'll tell you, all great ideas start with a big insight.
Yes.
And it's like that blank moment. And for me, I was like you and everybody, just playing around with generative AI. And I started to do searches on sustainability. And I would ask questions like, are Pampers diapers sustainable? Or is Unilever's Dove brand sustainable? And I was shocked how granular and detailed and precise the responses were. And in some cases, some of that data would come from the brand websites, but, you know, generative AI is a weird way. Imagine like a blender that just kind of takes best available knowledge, puts it in the blender, and then pours it in the mold that you then access.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that what
that's a really good metaphor.
Doesn't really change. Now you can change the how. You can say, give it to me as a Jay-Z rap or give it to me as haiku or give it to me as a sonnet. But the what, it's like one shot what.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, and it was funny because I typed in, are Pampers sustainable? And it was interesting because they said they're trying, but they're not, and here are the reasons, and here are some alternatives. And I thought, wow, that's like implicating for brands, right?
Yeah.
That's like a whole different level. And so I just thought, so the light bulb that went off, I thought, you know, maybe there's a business model in creating kind of a Nielsen ratings of AI search results and in helping brand builders understand where they stand in this world. And then could you use the I'm really passionate about digital marketing.
Right.
I kind of missed the role of being chief digital officer. You know,
you do that well.
Yeah, but I think that's at the forefront of change. And
what
I've noticed is that a lot of brands have gotten really lazy about – not lazy. It's just I don't think they are even aware that they're not serving consumers at the level that they should in this environment. So, for example, like what is
– stagnant.
What has generative AI really done? It's raised the bar for giving you answers with minimal friction.
Correct.
And with shocking levels of detail and a willingness to continue the dialogue.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you can just keep going.
You can.
And it feels like you're talking to a really smart best friend. And brands are really bad at that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go to most brands from, you know, whether it's Unilever, I mean, a bunch of them. I'm not going to name names. I don't want to piss anybody off locally. But yeah, if you go into their FAQs or their brand sites, you know, you're not going to get a lot of information.
Yeah.
Very, very little. So you're more likely to say, I'm going to learn about Pampers on generative AI. The problem with that is that that narrative often is counter to the brand's desired narrative.
Sure.
So what we're doing is we're kind of metering it, and we've run thousands of searches to really help brands understand, you know, how they stack up. And then we're benchmarking it versus competition. And then we're putting a lot of consulting on top of it. Like, it's not enough to just say, we metered your brand. It's like, here's what you need to do. And this gets tricky. Like, to really win in a world of generative AI, you have to market to algorithms. You have to understand how.
How do you market to algorithms?
Well, this is important. So we just put out a white paper called Brand Vulnerability in the Age of AI Search. And there's something that's called Algorithmic Anchors.
Okay.
And so it has some similarities to Search 1.0, but in the generative AI, there are clear anchors that disproportionately influence what is being said about you.
Okay.
So if I'm looking up Rob Richardson,
okay,
it's probably going to be one of your algorithmic anchors is probably going to be UC content.
Yep,
okay. You have a legacy of leadership here. It's shaped your brand. And I would say UC is on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd probably give them a 7 or 8 in terms of marketing algorithms. So your content has a good chance of getting to those algorithms. Okay. Brand websites are very, very, if they're done right, are very important algorithmic anchors, but it's not just the websites, it's how you build it. So for example, I was meeting with someone from Kroger the other day.
Okay.
And Kroger's actually doing some pretty good work on zero waste, zero hunger. I read all their reports.
Right.
But I noticed they weren't getting enough credit in like the AI algorithms, and I suddenly dawned on me that they put most of their best data in PDFs.
Oh, well, that'll do it.
Okay. Yeah. And so you don't, it's not like you go to like a FAQ engine to get it. It's like in a PDF, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, they're right. Like, they're only getting a fraction of the ROI on all that work. Think of all that work. Think of all the Rodney speeches. Think about all those hundreds of employees that have kind of toiled to kind of get those statistics on the table. And then when you got to the last mile of helping the consumer to understand it, you put it in a file that the algorithms don't understand. And so I think, you know, we're almost trying to figure out scorecards that make it easy for brands to see, ah, this is what I need to do to get full credit.
Okay.
Now, in some cases, you won't get full credit because you're not sustainable. You might be dishonest, you know, and again, the algorithms will go to town on you in that respect. But I think generally speaking,
like, how are they going
to
know you if you're dishonest? Like, how would they know?
Well, because they're looking at a lot of sources. I mean, I'd say the brand websites are clearly the most, the biggest cheerleaders for their own.
Well, they're
brand.
Biased. They should
okay.
be. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's an advertising
right,
vehicle.
Exactly.
But, I mean, why is the New York Times suing OpenAI for $20, $40 billion?
Because, it's taken
then place. They know that their source of truth is being thrown into the blender.
Yep.
It's very hard for people to see the attribution, but they know it is weaving in. Now, New York Times articles are pretty harsh about brand. I mean, they just kind of speak the truth, right?
Right.
And there's other sites. It could be Wikipedia. Google just spent, what, $40 million to license Reddit?
Yep.
So that stuff's getting weaved in. Right. Ratings and reviews are creeping into it as well. Mm. So one thing that we're working on, and I can't get too specific, but I will say that this institution is helping our thinking
right.
a lot, is really trying to develop some science around those sources of attribution.
Got it.
Like, what are those anchors?
Oh,
and how
great.
Do you get really precise? And I would love for Greater Cincinnati to be a true hub for search analytics, yep. AI search analytics. And it's going to take some work, but I think we can figure it out. And I think the universities are a big part of that. But I think every brand needs to understand what is disproportionately impacting their search results.
What would you say is your top three advice? Just one. What are the top three things brands need to do in the age of algorithms to protect their brand identity?
Some of it is old-fashioned guidance. I mean, this, you got to listen, and these are different signals. So in the same way that you would listen to a consumer in a focus group, or listen to website data, or listen to social media conversation, you got to listen to these new search dynamics.
Yeah.
And that's, we're kind of providing a tool that helps them listen. And then they need to act on it. I mean, they need to disrupt.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're trying to provide a data set that makes it easier to disrupt.
Right.
In most cases, data lead you to incrementalism.
Exactly.
We're kind of saying, you've got a long way to go.
So brands need to move faster.
Your website sucks. It doesn't, you know, the websites don't pay attention. Right. The algorithms don't pay attention to it. Or, you know, and yeah, so we're trying to, and then you got to follow up, and you got to be really iterative. Like I would say, you know, if you look at our online site, we say, today brands need to think and act like algorithms. It doesn't mean we're all going to become bots, but we have to understand how our whole future is going to get dictated by this
right.
stuff. But we can get in front of it. We can partner with it, but we got to understand what it is. And I think that's critical for everyone.
Tough question here. What happens if the algorithms know us better than we know ourselves?
They will. I mean, you know, next year you're probably going to be interviewing yourself as a deep fake, right? You know, Two Faces of Rob podcast.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Right?
That'd be interesting.
Exactly.
Yes.
That might be so I don't know. It's going to get really tricky. I mean, we're going to have to really reboot not only brands, we're going to have to reboot training.
Yep.
We're going to have to, I personally think we're going to have to shake up the universities to think differently.
K through 12, all of it.
I mean, think about it. Like with generative AI, I got Socrates in my pocket.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like an incredible learning experience. It teaches math. It never forgets anything.
Yep.
It's like, and so the potential for personalized education is
absolutely.
Huge, but there's going to have to be give and take at the university level, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's going to be tricky.
It is going to be tricky.
Like, how will Neville Pinto lead? I mean, I've even wrote a letter to him once. I said, dude, like, this will shape your legacy more than anything, full stop. I'd say
right.
the same thing to John Mueller at P&G or Rodney at Kroger. This is like how you manage this is critical.
I agree.
You know, and if you know that there's going to be, you know, job shakeups, how do you get in front of it? How do you start thinking about the new jobs? How do you manage expectations? How do you turn it into a positive? I know that sounds romantic, but it's going to be tricky.
No, it's going to be really, really tricky. It's you know, before we go on to our other points, there's one line I read from you about customer satisfaction. That's very important, I think, even more with algorithms, because mm-hmm. I think you said this. You said if you have one successful customer, they tell three people. If you have one bad customer, they tell 3,000. And now algorithms.
That was my book.
Right. Yeah, yes, yeah. That's your book. Yeah, I see. And algorithms now, you can add to that. You give one good customer, maybe you'll get six. You give one bad customer, maybe you'll get 3 million, because the information can really just iterate on itself much faster.
Well, I think the key, Rob, is that we need to understand how to balance automation and intimacy.
That's good. Okay, what? Tell
really
me more.
Important. So I'll say more. Like, so I led, when I was running digital at Nestle, you know, one of my number one initiatives was implementing Service Cloud across all the markets, okay. You know, and the market I most admired was in China. And it was the Wyeth Nutrition brand. And I used to, when I go to China, I would just spend time in the call center.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because they were really good at balancing automation and intimacy. In fact, they were very good at converting like moms to e-commerce opportunities. In fact, okay. They use WeChat, which is like their version of Facebook or yeah, Instagram. Yeah. And they would kind of do it at scale. And on one hand, they wanted to automate a lot of it, but other times if they knew there was an upsell opportunity, they would, they would have folks, you know, doing the chat and kind of working it. And then, or if a mom had a complaint about their child, then you automatically defaulted to a human. And so I think there's just this balancing act on how do you get the benefits of automation. And I think some of that could get really good. I mean, if you can automate a friendly bot or a employee and they're just answering questions, but with a happy face, I think that could be a big benefit. But if there's anything that's on the negative side or the sensitive side, or the product has poison or whatever, then you want to immediately go to a human. And I think it's going to be really important.
Or health or lots of other stuff. Yep.
Yeah. Like, I don't think people should over romanticize 100% automation. I think you just need to find the right balance to do it right. And it's the same thing with, there's certain things we like on the airline where we can kind of get automatic alerts. In other cases, just get on the damn phone for crying out loud. Yeah. And they know that there's a calculus that says if they completely ignore Pete when he really needs us, he's going to go from Delta to American.
Exactly.
You know, so.
Now, what would you tell young people nowadays in this state? There's been more tech layoffs, I think, than we've ever seen since you and I went through the aging ourselves, but the .com burst and bubble. There's a lot of tech layoffs. It's a very shaky time for people that are in tech that have been in careers that have always been thought to be untouchable, right?
Yeah, big time.
What do you say to those emerging in their career at this time? Like, what advice would you give them at this moment?
I mean, number one, just eyes wide open.
Yeah,
and it's funny. My daughter's an incredible. One of my daughters is this incredible artist, and we were talking about, she's only a sophomore, and we were talking about college, and I was actually rattling off a number of design schools, including UC Stapp, and it was funny, like, she was like, you know, hey, is all of that going to be relevant? It was very perceptive. It's sort of like, you know, isn't that going to get kind of automated by AI? And, you know, some of it will, but a lot of it won't, and I think we're going to have to remind our young people that we're also in a renaissance of creative confidence. Like I'm sure you feel the same thing. Like, my creative confidence quotient has gone up dramatically.
Absolutely.
Because I've got all these helpers.
Absolutely.
I am, I'm writing better with a little bit of help. I'm taking sometimes scatterbrained concepts and turning them into beautiful concepts that are kind of
I can concur with that.
And I think everyone's got artistic qualities that are probably severely underleveraged.
Yep.
And so we need to figure out how do we almost bring more creativity in the world using those tools, but we're going to have to lead that thinking. But at the same time, we may have to tell the programmer that programming as we knew it before is not going to be as critical.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got the CEO of NVIDIA basically saying all this obsession with teaching every kid to be a coder is nuts. And he's the head of NVIDIA.
Yeah.
And so now prompts, experimentation, how do you turn rocks over? How do you test and learn? I mean, I think we're in a renaissance of that. I mean, I have written, I kid you not, maybe I'm a bit of a freak, but since I discovered generative, I've probably written 100 business concepts all the way down to images.
Yeah.
I think my last team thought I was crazy, but I am like a real entrepreneur. Yeah. And it's like, and like the things that when I was at PNG that would take like months to kind of get, I'm like literally like doing like overnight.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote a concept this morning before I came here for a new product. And so that it's to some extent, like the ideas and the concepts that we have in our mind can be formalized and laid out. And I think we just got to teach the young people to do this. Like think of all the great businesses that can be created.
I agree. I have a bit of a slight take on that, a different take. I would say that you can do those things well because you also have some training experience.
Like consumer process. Understanding.
Right.
Like, well, I would
so
say like.
So you have these. So like, so I want to, because, and I still think there are skill sets to learning how to program, but I do, I completely agree with this. Creativity has to be a part of what you do. You have to, can't be one dimensional in anything you do anymore. Like it is not it's not going to be. So my advice would be you don't be one dimensional, right? Can't just say, people want to go in sometimes say, I just want to do this. That world is done. Like you have,
or to your point, I mean, think about some of the things that you typically learn in university, like critical thinking, right? How to interrogate. Now that's as relevant as ever.
That's always going to be relevant.
You're going to be constantly interrogating the bots.
Yep.
You know, and it's going to be a long time before the deep fakes go away or the hallucinations and what is real, what is not, what is a logical sequence of dialogue. And I think these, you know, we may find that the things we always wanted kids to learn via universities are going to be amplified in this world.
Exactly.
Highly. I don't say like I've got Plato in my pocket loosely. I mean, this is a highly dialectical process, right?
Right.
I mean, you're going back and forth like 20 times more than you would in
your typical class. But you have to know how to do that.
Well, but
that's a skill.
And I think that's where
that's
you might find that some of the universities go back to some of the basics.
Right.
Just to kind of get
because
that
some
right.
people like, oh, communication, everybody doesn't need to know how to communicate. More people are going to have to really know how to communicate. It's very important. I also believe that creativity is going to be highly important still. You know, I think we're both at a more creative moment, but at the same time, I think we're, as a society, less creative than we've ever been, right? I think about, like, musicians, for example. Like, I just, like, and this doesn't, makes me feel old, but I look at the music now, and there's nowhere near the musical input. And I think this started a while ago, right? But, like, think about what Michael Jackson, even original rappers did. They told stories, they put things into them. Now you can automate things, but it's not as good quality. People still like originality. So I think in the age of artificial intelligence, like one of my friends, Lisa Fancify, she's actually in the crypto world and she's in the AI world. She said, in the world of artificial intelligence, you need authentic intelligence. We are one of one.
I mean, you can only fake talent so far. Right,
right. Right.
I artificially more musical than I really am. But, you know, you still have to have the foundation of talent.
You
it's
do.
The same way.
But it's going to help you amplify it.
That's my
point. Like, the tool should be seen that way. And I think people are still, to your point you mentioned earlier, when you talked about, I never heard it phrased this way, you know, making sure you had a mixture between automation and intimacy. I look at that same way, like authenticity and artificial intelligence. You need to have authenticity.
Oh, big time. Absolutely.
And that's what's going to differentiate.
That's what I love about what Kendra and Helen are doing.
Absolutely.
I mean, that whole human in the loop, it's a big part of our model. Like, it's interesting. Like, I'll give you a good example. So we're putting out reports that are very data-based, but throughout the report, you can click a button and there's Pete in the studio explaining how to use it with all of Pete's passion and authority. And it's really called data theater.
Yeah. I'm going to give myself an avatar too. I got to do that.
But it's real. It's real me because data alone is not good enough. Sometimes I'm almost trying to channel my, you know, guilt tripping Italian mother to kind of get people to like act on the data. Data alone won't get you to act. And again, it's that balancing act that we need to perfect, and it's the human in the
loop. Data is guidance, it's not determinative. You have to, it's something you can use as a map, but it won't mean anything if you don't use it.
Yeah. These are all the things we've been told to do because rationally it's right.
Yeah.
Eat your peas.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like every study will tell you it's right, but you need like mom to say, God damn it, eat those peas or you're not, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we're not rational people, so we're going to go. I want to get to a few kind of lightning round questions that I ask people. So you have a committee of three, Pete,
to
advise you on life, business, whatever you want. Tell me who these three people are and why.
I really admire John Pepper, the former CEO of P&G. I just think he is just, he continues emailing him this morning on, and he's the type of person, if he asked me to do something, I'd say how high or jump, and he's consistently there and just always kind of wise, ethical, kind of system. You know, there's some, you know, I won't isolate it to one individual, but there's some folks from my Nestle experience who I just really like to bring to the table. Kind of think a lot of, you know, family members are always there in so many respects.
So you got one you put. You don't want to choose.
I need to think a little bit harder about the question.
I
will say I'm leaning on, I'm for certain things, I'm a lot on my kids.
That's fine. That's a good answer.
My daughter Layla is like a source of incredible insight. So is my daughter Sophia, my son Liam. And, you know, you have to like be humbled to know what you don't know. And almost there's a certain innocence in the world that they see. And so, but I, you know, I generally try to, you know, listen to a lot of signals.
Humble what you don't know. That's great. Let me ask you the opposite of that question.
Yeah.
What do you know for sure? The Oprah question.
And I know that I don't know, I'm trying to steal Plato or Aristotle, but, you know, I'm pretty humble about the fact that there's still a lot, and that, you know, knowledge is a quest that never entirely find an endpoint truth. I'm really fanatical about understanding. Kind of guided everything I've done, and to some extent a lot of that is in this. And trust your inner that you're probably going to find all sorts of great business ideas and the like.
All right, what's an important truth you have that very few people agree with you on? Always a fun one for me.
And I would say it goes back to what I said before. I think you know, the trust your inner consumers, I gave a TED talk on it. I think we use that sometimes, and
what specifically is the belief that people disagree with you on? I didn't understand. Tell me again.
What do you mean?
Like, what's an important truth you have that most people may disagree with?
Some people may disagree with that. It's almost like, because I've always believed that if you trust your inner consumer, you're almost bringing more of an outside in activist perspective.
Okay.
I think in business sometimes
what does that mean to trust your inner consumer?
So it basically means I've always been I give a TED talk called The Work Life Advantage, and it was all about how the things we do in our personal lives in digital really inform how we become business leaders. Okay. So you've got to do social media yourself. It'll kind of teach you about the power of iteration. You need to walk the talk. You need to, you need to become a good e-commerce shopper to really speak with authority when you're managing a team about winning with Amazon. And right. So it's like, And you also, you know, as consumers, we're pretty damn critical, right?
Yes. I mean,
sometimes we let it out. We're kind of, you know, we get really angry. We tell 3,000. And so, but that journey is what makes us really sharp. Now, why do I feel like I'm qualified to go launch a startup? There's probably a million startups doing AI. Honestly, I've been trusting my inner consumer. I'm using this stuff like 100 times a day. I see a future that others don't because I'm channeling my consumer side. And I think that's always going to be my source of truth, my source of motivation. And I don't think that truth will ever go away.
All right. Final question. What does success look like for you, your business, or yourself in 5 years?
I mean, I want to make a big, it's funny. I want monetary wealth, but I'm not motivated by it. Motivated by the feeling that I did something in me had a positive. Sounds like lofty and idealistic, but it's just where I am in my age. Like if people read my epitaph or give a speech at the funeral and they don't say that I really moved them, did it very thoughtfully, I'll be really disappointed wherever I am. And, I want to drive real impact. I've always been that. I mean, when I grew up, I wanted to be governor of California. Kind of, I started, and to some extent, I've almost tried to drive.
You and I have that in common.
Yeah, I mean, Planet Feedback, my first business, was a bit of a stick it to the man, but it also had a business side to it. So I've always like blended that, you know, drive impact, build a great business. And to some extent, I feel like I'm doing that now because I like the idea of accountable. Like, don't talk about sustainability and not do it.
Right.
You know, so I'm kind of blaming it on the AI. The AI bots say you're lying or you're greenwashing. But I like that. It's like, you know, because I think it also drives to better outcomes. It might speed up companies to actually meeting their green commitments or realizing they can't go slow.
Right.
You know, so those are the things I really like.
Yeah, Pete Blacksaw, been a pleasure, man.
Hey, thanks for all your leadership. That was fun.
Thank you.
Good.